Hi, and welcome to this, the 10th in the series of Torquay Museum Society's Spring Lecture Programme. I'm delighted to say that today we have with us Professor Terry Gifford, who is a visiting research fellow at the University of Bath Spa. Today, Terry will be talking to us about the six stages of the greening of Poet Laureate Ted Hughes. So sit back and enjoy. Thank you very much.
Hello. So I'm Terry Gifford, and I'm delighted to be talking to the Torquay Museum Society in your lecture series on the six stages of the greening of Ted Hughes. I'm really disappointed that I'm not in Torquay. My wife and I were really looking forward to staying a couple of nights in Torquay. We've discovered the South Devon Coastal Path. We had some marvellous walks either side of Salcombe last summer, and we were looking forward to doing that. So we'll do that soon. I'm not sure that I know that any other writer has been analysed in terms of the stages of the greening of their writing. And so I think this is a first time, and I'm particularly interested in the work of Ted Hughes and have been since 1967. I'm going in this talk to remind myself of Ted Hughes's passion for the rivers of Devon. And so one of these six stages will very much focus on the River of Devon, rivers of Devon. And I've used some photographs by my friend Mark Walmold, who is the current chair of the Ted Hughes Society, to punctuate this lecture with pictures of the rivers of Devon. But first of all, here's his picture of me at the elusive Ted Hughes Memorial Stone up on Dartmoor, very close to the source of the Tor, which is in that ditch on the left of this slide. This is on a raised bit of ground where two rivers really rise, the Tor on the left in that ditch there, which of course flows through North Taunton, where Ted Hughes lived in North Devon for the bulk of his life. So a bit of context. Ted Hughes, born in 1930 and died as Poet Laureate in 1998, actually lived in a period between 1960 and 1980 when the countryside somehow transmogrified into the environment. And suddenly we were living in an environment where previously we'd been reading literature about the countryside. And I've written about this. You'll find an essay on my website if you want to look further into this. That I'm very interested in how a tradition of writing that might be called pastoral becomes post-pastoral, because literary ruralism was transformed into scientifically informed, locally threatened, globally venerable ecology. And suddenly what had been people's gardens now became habitats. And a book like H.V. Morton's England, a pastoral evocation of the English countryside, was published in 1975. And in 1973, a book could be published by Richard Mabey called The Unofficial Countryside, sitting alongside the pastoral. And during this period, Ted Hughes launched an environmental magazine, the first before the Ecologist magazine, called Your Environment. and he reviewed an important book called The Environmental Revolution. So suddenly we're moving from a pastoral England to an environment in which a revolution is taking place. And during this period, there was increased membership of CND, the Formation of Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, and the RSPB hugely increased its membership as people discovered their gardens were habitats and were now the habitats for birds. So this is also a period in which traditional nature poetry for a short time became green poetry and is now called eco-poetry. So if you go to an anthology of eco-poetry, you find quite a lot of what was formerly regarded as traditional nature poetry. An anthology like Neil Astley's Earth Shattering really illustrates this very well. So here's my first Devon River, the dark gorge between Dartmeet and home. And I'm going to begin with the fields which Ted Hughes walked among as a kid in the first 8 years of his life in the Calder Valley, his N Terrace house where he was born, number 1 Aspinall Street, in the village of Mythomroyd. From the front door, you looked out at a very steep slope of a series of fields going up to a moorland edge. And at the back of the house, very close by, was the canal where his first fishing took place. Fishing will emerge as a real Devon theme through this talk. So I've been going to the archives for a number of years of Ted Hughes, and this is Ted Hughes's handwriting, which those of us who are studying his work have to decipher. And I want to begin with his memory, which I found in the archive in Emory University in Atlanta in America, a draft for a piece which was eventually published, in which he says, the first half of the climb over these fields opposite his house, the first one 100 yards above our house, was a domestic incline belonging to the co-op, heavily grazed, usually pasturing a herd of cows. The second field belonged to the farms above. It was poorer, wilder, a little steeper, and in it you began to feel the volume of space, the unaccustomed weight of open sky, and you saw that the ridge of Scout Rock was a ridge below the further ridge of moor, and moor was friendly. In the third, much steeper field, you began to feel bird-like, with sudden tempting out into the valley air. From that field, kites would stand out at a great height, and the traffic below on the main road was like slow insects. The last field was in your face, and it was often almost a toiling stair to reach the farms perched on the headlands or lines of land halfway up the valley sides. So here's a kid actually charting a change of feeling in moving up from one field to another. I don't know whether you remember favorite places that you explored as a kid and the particular feeling that you got from each of those places. Academics would now call this psychogeography, the way in which the psyche is changed by the geography of walking up from field to field. He continues, from there, the return home was a return into the pit. I can still see that in some ways, perhaps that revelation, intense as in a dream, ordered my life, though it would be impossible to say how. This stuff in red was actually cut from the published edition of this called The Rock and published in a book called Worlds. So this red was what he decided not to include. Some lucky people have a religious awakening and some have unquestionable principles drilled into them. Against those, perhaps, I would set my memory of moorland, the timeless light, the crumbling stone, an abandoned empty place where the rocks, the birds, the silence, the flowers waited like gifts, full of something wonderful, if only one could learn to interpret their sounds or signs. And then in a redraft on a separate sheet, he continues, the bit in black was published, after each walk along the moor or along its edge, I must have returned less and less of myself to the valley. This is where the division of body and soul began. That will no doubt cause me a lot of trouble. He decided to edit out that anticipation of the trouble of the division between body and soul. This is the Torridge below Great Toddington, which takes us to the second phase. In 1938, the family moved to Mexborough in South Yorkshire, and instead of accompanying his older brother by 10 years up on the moors shooting animals, and he was the retriever dog for his brother in those enterprises, he now decided that capturing animals was better than shooting animals. And in his marvelous talks for kids, published in the Poetry in the Making, he writes, looking at them from their own point of view, at the age of 15, he said, I accuse myself of disturbing their lives. So he started trapping animals, studying animals, and writing about animals. Here is an extract from an otter. Otter hunting was still legal and active during this period. And he describes the otter as yanked above hounds. He reverts to nothing at all. When he's dead, he's just this long pelt over the back of a chair. It's the vitality, the life in animals that makes them what they are. He's fishing for pike. And he writes about, in the poem Pike, the dream darkness beneath night's darkness had freed, that rose slowly towards me, watching. As a sense of the environment actually watching him as he is watching it, and a great kind of reciprocal connection being established through the focus of fishing for pike. And in Poetry in the Making, he writes, like wild creatures to the hunter, poems appear to the writer as bearers of the perfectly beautiful, perfectly true, sacred image, which satisfies the deepest biological hunger. Hughes believed that we still had a deep biological hunger to connect with nature, and observing nature, hunting nature, was one of the ways in which human beings did that. The killing and eating of wild creatures, alas, raises the most primitive feelings of the killing and eating of the god. In my boyhood obsession with laying my hands on the prey, I was extremely aware of that primitive religious aura. It was something that shifted easily into art, the making of images, embedding them in ritual settings. This is a second reference to the religious attention that writing poetry demands from the writer engaging with nature. Here's the Tamar at Ensley. Well, he married Sylvia Plath. They went to America, spent a year in America, came back in 1959. And his great university friend, Daniel Hughes, said to me that when Ted came back from America, he was an environmentalist. Something had happened that had changed him. In that year in America, he didn't write about American environment. He remembered being on Holderness doing national service there, and wrote the poems which became his second collection, Lupercal, in America. And here is a latent environmentalism. He's describing the River Humber coming out the north of the Holderness Peninsula. Graves, dunghills, kitchens, hospitals, the unkillable North Sea swallows it all. And in a poem called The Last Migration, written in America, he writes about the Irish elk, the auroch, the passenger pigeon, the buffalo, slaughtered by human species. In America, he read Rachel Carson, and he and Sylvia Plath both read The Edge of the Sea. Carson wrote a series of books about really wonderful lyrical books about the life in the sea. In 1959, the year Ted Hughes left America, she wrote a letter to the Washington Post about the effects of DDT. And in 1962, the silencing of birds was the phrase that she used in an article in the New Yorker. All of this led to, when Hughes is back in the UK, the publication of Silent Spring, a book which is often regarded as one of the cornerstones of the modern environmental movement. Spring was going to be silent because of the use of DDT, pesticides in farming, was infiltrating wildlife in nature. Mark Warmold described this photograph to me as Ted Hughes's paradise, the torridge between Iddesleigh and Meath. So in 1970, having come back from America, he persuades his friends to join him in launching a magazine called Your Environment. And David Ross takes over the editorship. At first, there's a group of them editing, but David Ross sees it through. And in the third issue, Hughes himself writes a review of Max Nicholson's important book, The Environmental Revolution. This review is published in Ted Hughes's prose that is called Winter Pollen. And in this, he writes about the Reformed Church in England separating from the Church of Rome, a Marian religion, a religion which was very much revering the feminine. And he describes this reform of Protestantism as a misogyny, which is appropriate to the fanatic rejection of nature. And so by 1970, Ted Hughes had a fully formed cultural theory of Western patriarchy's responsibility for the alienation from nature, the rejection of the feminine, the rejection of nature, that was in fact the current environmental crisis of 1970 that was beginning to be recognized. The Tarka Trail is the name given to a footpath that runs alongside the River Tor below the village of North Taunton. And Ted Hughes has a poem called 1984 on the Tarka Trail, in which he describes the effect of a neighboring farmer who is actually a bird watcher putting 300 weight of 2010-10 to the acre. This is a line of poetry, and this is quite a bold line of poetry. This is not what pastoral poetry had been used to dealing with. And the next line is 100 weight and a half of straight nitrum. Now, Hughes says to the reader, you are as loaded with the data that cultivates his hopes in this brief gamble as the river is, as he is too. This is water that is being polluted. It was actually Sylvia Plath's mother who came over, took the children to paddle beside the river at Biddeford, who pointed out that the water was full of raw sewage. And she said, this is not an appropriate place for the children to be playing. Well, Hughes then joined the Torridge Action Group, the Torridge flowing through and separating the town of Biddeford. And he wrote to a friend, I've been involved in a local battle of sorts over Biddeford sewage system. The Water Authority, mightily leaned on by local building interests, are putting in a type of sewage system that merely screens the sewage, takes out 20% solids, mostly cardboard, plastic, etc. 1,600 new houses go in immediately. This is 1984. And the Torridge Action Group were protesting at the inadequacy of this proposed screening sewage system. Of course, the Torridge was being used for water sports by holidaymakers. Here, local school children after school jumping into the river. I'd like to look just past that boat on the right, before the bridge, where this marker in the river here on the right, just on the edge of the mud, marks the place where the sewage outfall comes out into the Torridge River in 1984. And this was the source of anxiety for the Torridge Action Group. Well, there was a public inquiry, and Ted Hughes actually made a statement on behalf of the action group at the public inquiry. He wrote, "A local doctor has been heard to say that of the holidaymakers who stay here for a few days canoeing and windsurfing and using the estuary for similar sports, 75% contract an ailment that needs treatment. 9 doctors from the Wooder Surgery serving the Biddeford area had expressed their concern with the present situation. Biddeford chemists prepare for the tourist season as if for a campaign. The chemist in Mill Street displays a window sign advertising his cure for diarrhea." And I think this is probably the chemist shop in question. "And in spite of their conditioning, the local population does not escape. In general, they complain of an endless grumbling epidemic of throat and chest complaints and stomach disorders. In the 1984 tourist season, 200,000 people visited Biddeford. The effect of the estuary's pollution on the state of mind of the local residents is subjective and elusive. However, this depression is very real. Local people can feel in their bones that the whole situation is depressing. You do not have to be a super clean German or American to decide after one look at the sludge that the Torridge estuary is no place for a holiday." Well, the campaign group lost their campaign. And here is Biddeford Fine Screening Plant, which was built and put in place. Only later was a pipeline put through to the sea off Westward Ho to deposit the sewage out there, and that was the result of the efforts of the Torridge Action Group. Well, Hughes went on to help form the West Country Rivers Trust, which was concerned about the water quality of rivers in the West Country. And the West Country Rivers Trust eventually became a National Rivers Trust, which now combines 60 local river trusts. So that was a period of activism which informed Ted Hughes's book, River, and people reading River for the first time will have been quite unaware that of the activism that was behind these poems, which I was able to make public by going to the archive and discovering this statement in for the public inquiry. Well, then there is a very curious fifth stage in Hughes's greening, which is really concerned with hunting as a form of conservation. He's speaking here as a fisherman, and he gave an interview to an American magazine called Wild Steelhead and Salmon, which was published after he died in 1999. He died in 1998. in which he says in this interview, and this is something that he has written about, he did a piece for The Guardian about hunting deer on Exmoor. And this is his view. In my experience, both in Britain and the US, the conservation of species is managed almost entirely by hunters and fishermen or by their organizations. On the whole, the shooters I know are obsessed by the whole mesh of wildlife, just as the fishermen are obsessed by purity of water. All the river renovation down here has been initiated by fishermen. I mean, the actual cleaning of waterways. I think one of the really important things about the Torridge Action Group and then the formation of the Southwest Rivers Trust is Hughes's awareness that what is bad for the river is bad for the human species as well, and that river health is parallel to public health, and that this isn't just about getting rid of that plug of sewage which prevented the salmon returning up the Torridge to spawn. It's actually about the human species as well. But here is a point of view which contains a number of contradictions, because Hughes had written in a letter to his friend Keith Sagar, "I've known for some years what a hunted deer actually goes through physically." And in his article in The Guardian supporting deer hunting on Exmoor, it was as though it was a separate person from the person who had written this poem in Season Songs about the stag. "The stag doubled back weeping and looking for a home up a valley and down a valley, while the strange trees struck at him and the brambles lashed him, and the strange earth came galloping after him, carrying the lolling-tongued hounds to fling all over him. And his heart became just a club beating his ribs, and his own hooves shouted with hounds' voices. And the crowd on the road got back into their cars, wet through and disappointed." So here is the Tor. You saw the stone at the source of the Tor. This is looking back up the Tor towards Sheberton Tor. And we come to the sense of global concern for the environment in Hughes's writing. In 1992, Hughes wrote an important review of a book called Your World, largely a book of photographs. And this review was published in one of the Sunday color supplements. And it was a concern for the global state of the environment. Hughes had been concerned about human infertility since reading in 1982 John Elkington's book, The Poisoned Womb. He actually sent a copy of this book as poet laureate to Margaret Thatcher, because this book argued that pollution had corrupted human fertility that the human sperm count was decreasing globally. In the review of Your World, he wrote, "Many sporadic local recoveries, such as might be made in Devon Rivers, and advances, such as forming the Southwest Rivers Trust, do not reverse the cloudier global deterioration." He wrote to me about John Elkington's book, "What else falls when the sperm count falls? If the human race fails to survive all this, It will be because it can't get interested in its own annihilation. So here is a concern before we recognized really the full impact of what we now call the Anthropocene, the geological era in which human influence on the environment is so great that it will be recorded in the geological record in deposits of carbon and toxics. If the human race fails to survive all this, it will be because it can't get interested in its own annihilation. Prince Philip hosted a dinner which the poet laureate was present, as a result of which there was the formation of a group called Arts for Nature in 1997. And Hughes wrote about Prince Philip's concern for the global environment. His long experience in the environmental movement has given him a realistic sense of the colossal opposition set against it, the endless futility of the endless talk. Vested interests of government and commerce neutralize every inconvenient argument with their hired science. Hired science had been set against Rachel Carson in America. Hired science had said the rivers of Devon were perfectly pure and acceptable, when it was obvious to the fishermen that this was not the case. And here is Hughes's sense that the Duke of Edinburgh realizes that there are very strong vested interests involved in perpetuating what we now identify as, you know, the fossil fuel industry and so on. In his last years, Hughes did a translation of Ovid's Metamorphosis, which was published as Tales from Ovid. And it's written as though for a modern audience. The translation from the Latin here, actually in a tone that is speaking to a modern generation. So here's an extract from the Creation. And the first age was gold. So the second age is iron, second age is silver, and the third age is iron. The first age was gold, without laws enforcers. This age understood and obeyed what had created it. Listening deeply, man kept faith with the source. Listening deeply. Have we been listening deeply? Here, Hughes recognizes that the environmental crisis is a cultural crisis. It's a crisis of whether we have been listening deeply enough and responding to it. What are the sustainable means in which our species can keep faith with the source? So, after Hughes's death, a memorial stone was laid in Westminster Abbey, and on that stone were the last lines of a fishing poem called That Morning from the Collection River. It's about a journey that he made with his son to fish in Alaska. And so the we of this poem is father and son. And the poem ends, and so we found the end of our journey. So we stood alive in the river of light, among the creatures of light, creatures of light. Earlier in the poem, The bears have been described sitting in this river just upstream from the fishermen, eating the salmon. Here is an image of the human species not only integrated, standing alive and feeling alive in the river, but amongst the bears. So I think that first creatures of light is father and son. That second creatures of light are the bears, the salmon, the other creatures. And here is an image of integration, of being connected with, feeling at home in nature as a fellow hunter alongside the bears, but experiencing that very aliveness that's given an aura of light in the river of light. So I end with an image of a fisherman on the dart. I hope that's been interesting, and I look forward to any questions at all. Thank you.